Hey guys, welcome back. You're listening to Gossip Inked, the way to gossip intelligently. Gossip Inked is a podcast that helps listeners learn critical thinking concepts by applying them to well-known pop culture events and real-world technology-focused examples. Here with us today, we have Karen Frost and Caitlin Hopkins. And I'm Bobby Jean Apostolos, and I'm fascinated. Although all three of our participants today do work for Microsoft, the views expressed on this podcast belong to us alone, and we do not represent the views of Microsoft.
Welcome to the show, Bobby Jean. Since this is your first time here, we have to ask, what is your favorite piece of gossip and why?
Okay, that's a good question. I think mine's kind of two parts. I do love celebrity gossip that is a piece of gossip that's related to previous behavior. So I can go research or I can see some sort of pattern. You know, when gossip comes your way and it's just floating in space and you have nothing to really reference. Those ones aren't as interesting to me. So if there's something that you see in previous interactions or there's something to kind of dig into, I like that. Aside from that, celebrity gossip that really interests me is the dynamic within relationships. How do people get into scandals? How do they navigate scandals after they have occurred? I really like that. I like learning the dynamics of intimate relationships.
Do you have a particular celebrity couple that you're heavily invested in?
Oh, I watched every single episode of the Johnny Depp Amber Heard. Obviously, I need to move on with my life. We have to move on. I need to move forward. But I watched every hour of that trial. It was fascinating. Such a private person to open the curtains and let us all in into something that was very complicated. I don't think anyone really has any full concept of what occurred between that relationship except for the two of them. But to invite us, probably very much against his will, to let us learn about how they navigated a very complicated relationship, I found that fascinating.
Yeah, me too. I followed that very, very closely. And it was the first celebrity-related trial that I had ever watched and followed.
I think we're too young for OJ.
I definitely am.
I have to admit, I followed all of the Amber Heard, Johnny Depp stuff as well. I think a lot of America did. And I think it spoke to a lot of things that America's interested in. We love dirty laundry, but we're also interested in these two competing accusations that really go against the public personas of these two individuals. In a he said, she said, I think all of us want to sit there and come up with our own opinion. So, Bobby Jean, since this is a critical thinking podcast, what do you think is a critical thinking skill that most people should have, but maybe they don't?
That's a good question, Karen. You know, when it comes to critical thinking skills, what are people probably missing today? First and foremost, I kind of think the whole thing, the whole umbrella of analytical thought and applying methodology to a topic and thinking it through. You know, a lot of times we talk with passion nowadays and make an argument based on our feelings and emotions. So I would say through the education piece of just knowing how to do analytical thinking, I think is one. I think people are missing the mark on how to do that. There's structure. And I really love that you guys bring that to the table. I mean, gossip is such a cool thing to talk about. It's easy. Everyone's relatable. And then you guys are applying this analytical overtone to it. And I'm really excited about being part of this. But I don't know if I had just one piece that I think is probably missing. I'm going to say I think a lot of times we're missing the whole thing. Speaking of critical thinking, this week's structured analytic technique, it's called What If. Karen, what is this topic? What is this technique? Tell me about it.
What If is a challenge or contrarian technique. It forces us to think just a little harder about an event that we may be absolutely certain would never happen, and walk through how it could. In our last episode, we looked at the high impact, low probability structured analytic technique. For this technique, we looked at the fallout of an event. We didn't care as much how that event might happen, only what happens after. But today's what if technique is the reverse. We're focused on what's happening leading up to an event, and we don't care as much about what happens after it. This technique is useful because it helps us develop signposts or indicators that for some reason, events are trending in the direction of our what-if scenario. It may help us realize that an event may be more likely to happen than we realize. So let's say our scenario was that terrorists stormed the White House and held the president hostage. In this case, we're asking, what if the White House was captured by terrorists? Or another way to phrase our issue would be to ask, how could the White House be captured? To answer this question requires some imagination. Maybe we posit a scenario in which our imaginary terrorists use a two-pronged attack method. They capture an aircraft to mount an air attack on the White House, and at the same time, they have heavy weaponry, like anti-aircraft guns, hidden in vans that they pull up outside the White House gates and use to launch a ground assault. But wait, it's actually a three-pronged assault. No one could simply storm the White House from outside and successfully reach the president. So our terrorists have moles inside the building who have hidden weapons that they use to neutralize the Secret Service and take the president hostage. Our scenario started with what seemed impossible, terrorists capturing the President of the United States in the White House, and lays out a debatably plausible scenario for how that could occur. The likelihood of this particular sequence of events happening is irrelevant. What matters here is that our exercise shows us that there are at least three potential avenues of attack against the White House: air, ground, and insider threat. If we were the Secret Service and we were updating our plans to protect the president from any and all threats, we would want to go through wild brainstorms like this so we could be sure we'd thought of all possible scenarios and developed countermeasures for them.
Okay, hold it, Karen. Did you seriously just use the plot of Olympus Has Fallen in explaining that technique just now?
Absolutely. A lot of Hollywood action movies are what-if scenarios. What if a bunch of thieves tried to break into a vault in Las Vegas during a zombie apocalypse? What if a terrorist acquired a nuclear weapon and only one person in the entire world had the spy skills to stop them? What if an asteroid was hurtling at Earth and we had to send Ben Affleck and Bruce Willis to stop it? When storytelling, we often like to think about either how something could happen or what would happen if it did. These are what-if and high-impact, low-probability structured analytic techniques applied to literary fiction. But of course, what-if isn't just a Hollywood trope. There are real-world applications as well. For example, what if you quit your job and moved to a Caribbean island? Walking through the technique, you would have to think through things like how to pay for the initial move, how would you make money in your new home, what to do about your pets, and things like that.
Okay, so what I'm hearing is the technique includes a lot of dreaming or imagining. It's not as structured in the beginning there. But how do you actually structure the technique then?
Our first step, of course, is to come up with our scenario. Traditionally, people using this technique have used unlikely scenarios. The what if the president of the United States was taken hostage by terrorists example. But outside of academic applications, this really isn't necessary. The what if technique is about understanding pathways and influencing factors so we can use basically any scenario, regardless of its likelihood, to better understand how events might lead there. A quirk of this structured analytic technique is that if we were writing our scenario down, for example, in a paper, we would start from the point of view that the event had already happened. Everything would be written in the past tense. But if we're chatting among friends, we might project forward and frame it as a future scenario. Another difference between theory and practice is that in theory, our scenario would be a high-impact one. What if North Korea launched a nuclear weapon at the United States, for example? But as I said before, in practice, there's no reason our scenario has to be high stakes. We can apply the technique to any scenario. Next in our structured analytic process, we ask ourselves, how did we get here? We'll have to think backwards to imagine specific events or situations that would lead to the scenario we chose. We want these events to make sense and work together logically. For example, if our scenario was that a corporation had bought an island and turned it into a theme park featuring a herd of cloned woolly mammoths, one of those events would have to be the discovery that mammoth fetuses could either be carried to term by elephants or incubated in artificial wombs. Another event would have to be the acquisition of woolly mammoth DNA from a university or museum. Sometimes there will be multiple plausible pathways to an event. For example, what if a sitting U.S. president died in office? The path to that final scenario could be assassination, heart attack, or illness. Whether there ends up being just one pathway or multiple, we want to create signposts and indicators that go with each one. What if isn't just a fun exercise that lets us stretch our imagination by envisioning implausible scenarios, although it's also that. The technique's utility lies in helping us predict in advance what clues we might see if the improbable was suddenly becoming possible. In my woolly mammoth example, the announcement that a commercial company had acquired mammoth DNA with the goal of finding a way to clone a live specimen would be a huge clue that we were headed in the direction of a future Holocene park. One of the best things we can learn from structured analytic techniques is that by training ourselves to automatically think about signposts and indicators in a situation, we can pick up on trends and patterns well before other people. This is a huge part of critical thinking. We end the what-if exercise with a short consideration of the impact of the scenario occurring. We don't want to do a full treatment because that would turn the technique into high-impact, low-probability. But we do want to have some sort of idea of how good or bad the ramifications of the scenario would be. In the case of a woolly mammoth theme park, we can all agree it would be amazing to see woolly mammoths in person. But what if there was mass commercialization of former eras? China building saber-toothed tiger theme parks? Canada building a real Cretaceous park? We learned from all the Jurassic Park movies that trying to build a dinosaur theme park will always end in catastrophe. But assuming no dinosaurs break free and eat the visitors in real life, what negative outcomes might there be? It's not necessarily a rhetorical question. If we go through our exercise and try to remove the Hollywood bias, maybe the positives of our imaginary Holocene park outweigh the negatives.
There's a lot to unpack there. So many questions. But since we are talking about pop culture, we have limited time. What is our actual pop culture example for today's episode?
Have you heard the rumor that singer Beyoncé faked her first pregnancy?
I did hear that one, but like, what happened with that?
Celebrity conspiracy theories are really interesting. There aren't a lot of them, but the ones that do exist are pretty wild. Did Tupac fake his death? Was Avril Lavigne replaced by a clone? We're used to conspiracy theories that suggest shady government activities, so it should come as no surprise that people come up with celebrity conspiracy theories as well. And when it comes to fake pregnancy conspiracy theories, Beyoncé isn't the first or last celebrity to be accused. In fact, there have been rumors that at least 14 celebrities used a surrogate and wore a prosthetic baby belly in order to make it seem as though they carried a child, when in fact someone else did. And while no celebrity woman has ever admitted to having done this, there's a strong belief in the gossip world that at least two of these celebs really did lie about being pregnant, even if the resulting child was theirs. But let's talk about Beyoncé in particular. The backstory to the Beyoncé faked her first pregnancy rumor is this. In October 2011, when Beyoncé was pregnant with Blue Ivy, she appeared on the Australian talk show Sunday Night HD. As she went to sit in the chair opposite the host, what very clearly appeared to be a prosthetic baby bump rapidly deflated and then reinflated. When still images and video of this moment hit the internet, they immediately sparked speculation that Beyoncé wasn't actually pregnant. Even other female celebrities claimed she must be faking. This wasn't just quietly whispered gossip either. Articles appeared all over the internet about the subject. Even today, you can still find not only the articles, but the pictures and video as well. Beyoncé immediately responded, calling the rumor that she wasn't actually pregnant stupid, ridiculous, and false. And in her 2013 HBO documentary, Life is But a Dream, she called it the most ridiculous rumor she'd ever heard about herself. Now, today's episode isn't about whether she did or didn't fake her pregnancy. So if you're listening and thinking we're gonna Sherlock Holmes Queen Bee, sorry to disappoint. But what we are going to do is imagine what would have had to have happened if she had faked her pregnancy. Our what if in this case is the question, what if Beyoncé faked her pregnancy? Or put another way, how could Beyoncé or any woman have faked a pregnancy? We're going to think of not only the steps she would have had to have taken, but signposts and indicators as well. The scenario that we'll start with is that for some reason, and we're not going to come up with theories why, Beyoncé used a surrogate to carry Blue Ivy while publicly portraying herself as carrying the baby. What would she have needed to do in order to pull this off? First, and most obviously, she would have needed a surrogate. Okay, that's easy. Beyoncé and Jay-Z are worth a combined $1.8 billion. They could have easily found a surrogate to carry one of Beyoncé's fertilized eggs. Moreover, that surrogate wouldn't even have to be located in the United States. To hide the existence of a surrogate, the surrogate could have been placed in Europe or almost anywhere around the world where she could have had continued access to high-quality medical care. Even if she was in the US, under HIPAA rules, any doctor or nurse would be legally barred from telling anyone that they had helped Beyoncé and Jay-Z use a surrogate, nor would they do so for ethical reasons. As for the surrogate or anyone not subject to HIPAA rules, with a high enough payoff, they would have no reason to spill the beans about what had happened. Second, Beyoncé would need a series of prosthetic bumps that would match the average growth of a pregnant woman's stomach. If she didn't go out in public often during the 9 months of the baby's gestation, she might get away with only three or four of these bumps. She wouldn't even necessarily have to hide the fake bumps with fabric to conceal seams or fasteners. As we've seen from Hollywood movies, the combination of a prosthetic bump and some makeup can make a fake bump indistinguishable from a real one. And it would be incredibly easy for Beyoncé to buy a prosthetic belly. A quick Google search shows they can be bought from eBay, Etsy, and even Walmart. Third, Beyoncé and her team would have to carefully manage not only the paparazzi, but also all of the people around her preparing her for public appearances. Hair and makeup people for interviews, for example, who might see signs she wasn't actually carrying a child. This would mean extending non-disclosure agreements beyond the immediate circle of employees. The last thing Beyoncé would want is someone from the wardrobe department letting slip they had seen the prosthetic belly. Fourth, Beyonce and Jay-Z's team would have to carefully orchestrate the birth so that no one but a small circle of medical staff at the hospital would know it was the surrogate and not Beyonce who gave birth. Even this might be easier to do than we might think. Again, under HIPAA, no nurse or doctor could legally say that Beyonce never gave birth at their hospital. All that would be required is that when the surrogate went into labor, or after, Beyonce herself go to a hospital. The baby would then be collected from the surrogate and given to her. Jay and Bey allegedly paid $1.3 million to seal off a wing at Lenox Hill Hospital, and their security patrolled the hallways to prevent anyone from seeing inside. Allegedly. It was even reported that tape was put over security cameras and employees had to turn over their phones when arriving for shifts so they couldn't take pictures. Under conditions like these, it would be easy to conceal the presence of a surrogate or slip the baby in from a waiting car. Fifth and finally, Beyonce would have to keep a record reminding her of pregnancy milestones during gestation. These are things like when the baby first kicked, what it felt like to be pregnant, and how long it was between when her water broke and she went into labor. Because she didn't experience these things firsthand, she'd have to learn them academically and then have to remember them. Something I find interesting about this example is how surprisingly easy it would be for someone like Beyonce to fake a pregnancy. A few fake baby bellies under dresses and a handful of grainy candid shots would be all it would take to throw people off the scent. If not for the deflating bump during the Australian talk show, no one would have questioned Beyonce's pregnancy at all. Not that I'm saying she did, by the way. Only that's what sparked suspicion. Now that we've got our scenario and our how we got here, what are signposts and indicators that we could come up with to identify whether a celebrity is faking their pregnancy? Or rather, a better question would be, are there indicators? I've mentioned in previous episodes that sometimes we as outside observers don't have access to the information that would allow us to track signposts, and this is one of those cases. Short of someone in the medical field illegally leaking information, we likely would never know if a surrogate had been used. Nor, I think we here at Gossipint would agree, is it any of our business. So maybe it's better we not come up with signposts. As a final note, just because a celebrity is wearing a fake baby bump doesn't mean she's not pregnant. I think there's enough evidence to suggest that one or more celebrities have used a fake bump to create a more striking effect in photos. It's hard to cradle a baby belly if there's not much belly to cradle.
Wow, so that analysis made this tidbit of gossip so much more interesting. In this podcast, we like to tie the gossip to the technology. So Caitlin, tell us, what is our technology topic today?
Rather than a tech topic, I think for today's episode, I'm going to talk about US statehood. Specifically, what if we added one or more new states? I chose this issue because it's a recurring topic of conversation in politics, and one that can be easily explored using the what-if structured analytic technique. Since no new state has been added to the Union since 1959, it can be difficult to imagine a change to our current situation. For one thing, 50 stars on our flag is a very nice even number. And if we added any more, we'd have to remake every single flag in the country. Not to mention, we'd have to add more seats to the Senate, which currently has a very pleasing 100 members. But the addition of a new state isn't necessarily as far-fetched as it may seem. The United States has 5 permanently inhabited territories: American Samoa, Guam, the Northern Mariana Islands, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, in addition to the District of Columbia. All 6 of these locations could technically become states, and at least Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia often discuss pursuing statehood. So how could that occur? Let's run through our what-if technique. So we begin by asking ourselves, what if Puerto Rico became the 51st state? Or how could Puerto Rico become a state? According to the Constitution, new states may be admitted by Congress into this union. Well, that's very vague, and it gives broad, almost unlimited power to Congress. By waving a magic wand, Congress can make a territory a new state. Or the reverse, it can withhold statehood. Since there's no clear roadmap for this process, Congress can basically do whatever it wants. For example, Utah formally asked for statehood 8 times over a period of 50 years before finally being admitted to the Union. Most recently, the process by which a territory has become a state is that that territory holds an internal referendum or vote on statehood. If the referendum passes, the territory then requests statehood from Congress, provided that Congress agrees that the territory's constitution and government are already in alignment with the rest of the United States. Congress passes that request by simple majority, after which the president signs the bill. So how does that play into our what-if scenario? It means that, in point of fact, our events leading to Puerto Rican statehood are very clear. Puerto Rico votes for statehood, The petition is submitted to Congress, Congress approves, and the president signs. Since we know the events that would lead to Puerto Rican statehood, let's do something a little bit interesting. Let's apply our signposts and indicators to what's already happened in real life. Now, as it turns out, these signposts and these indicators are actually the events themselves. So you might think of this more as, how close is Puerto Rico to becoming a U.S. state? Our first signpost is a Puerto Rican referendum, again a vote, on statehood that approves of statehood. Has this already happened? Yes. In fact, since 1967, six referendum votes have been held on the issue. In 2012, for example, 61% of Puerto Ricans voted for U.S. statehood. 9 months later, a Senate committee acknowledged this vote, but movement towards statehood stalled. In 2017, after Hurricane Maria caused catastrophic damage to the island, calls for statehood were again renewed as the island faced a humanitarian crisis. And in 2020, another vote was held, and 52% of Puerto Rican voters supported statehood. Our second signpost is a formal petition to Congress to admit Puerto Rico as a state. While this hasn't happened yet, we might say that pre-steps have been taken. In 2015, Puerto Rico's resident commissioner in the U.S. House of Representatives introduced the Puerto Rico Statehood Admission Process Act. This bill would authorize Puerto Rico's State Elections Commission to hold a vote on Puerto Rico's admission into the Union as a state within 1 year of the act's enactment. If a majority of the votes cast were for Puerto Rico's admission, the bill would require the president to issue a proclamation to begin the transition process. A modified version of the bill was reintroduced in the House in March of last year, and at the same time, the Puerto Rico Self-Determination Act of 2021 was also introduced. This bill called for creating a status convention made up of delegates elected by Puerto Rican voters. The delegates would be responsible for coming up with long-term solutions for the island's territorial status. So while there's been no official request yet, Congress has drafted multiple bills preparing for it if it does happen. The third signpost would be Congress passing a joint resolution recognizing Puerto Rico as a new state. This definitely hasn't happened yet. And even if Puerto Rico did petition for statehood, there's no guarantee that Congress would actually agree to it. Statehood would give Puerto Rico two senators, and after the next census, somewhere around five representatives, since it has roughly the same population as Connecticut. Questions of how prospective Puerto Rican members of Congress would vote may influence politicians' opinions of Puerto Rican statehood. For example, the Republican Party's platform states, "We support the right of the United States citizens of Puerto Rico to be admitted to the Union as a fully sovereign state." And Republican presidents, including Reagan, Ford, and George Bush Sr., also supported statehood for Puerto Rico. Despite that, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has openly opposed Puerto Rican statehood because it may mean Democrats pick up two Senate seats. The last signpost is the president signing the joint resolution passed by Congress, acknowledging Puerto Rico as a U.S. state. Again, this certainly hasn't happened yet, and it isn't guaranteed that the president would even sign a joint resolution that had bipartisan support. Presidents Andrew Johnson and Grover Cleveland both refused to sign new states into laws during their presidencies. And there we have it. After running through all of our prescribed indicators, we're at least a bit closer to understanding what has to happen in order for another star to be added to the U.S. flag.
Okay. I get that what if, how we covered that just now, but this podcast, we really want to focus on technical topics. Do we have one for today's episode?
Okay. Here's one that I've been thinking about that combines pop culture with tech. Do you remember that 2002 Tom Cruise movie, Minority Report? It was also made into a TV show and video game, but everything was based on a novella by Philip K. Dick. The idea behind it all is pre-crime, a predictive policing system that enables law enforcement to apprehend and detain people before they commit a crime. Now, in the story, the crimes are predicted by psychics using precognition. In a similar story by Isaac Asimov, however, future crime is predicted by a computer called Multivac, which generates its predictions using a comprehensive dataset about society. So here it goes. What if computers became so advanced they could predict criminal acts before they happened, and we use that information to arrest people before they'd committed their crimes?
Right, but in real life, that can never really happen, right?
No, it couldn't happen exactly that way, but the what if structured analytic technique asks us to ignore the likelihood of an event anyway, remember? So what would we expect to see in the lead up to the use of computers to predict crime? First, we definitely have to have quantum computing. And this is because the computers would require massive, massive amounts of data in order to extrapolate who would commit what future crimes. Then we would have to pass every bit of electronic data in the world through these computers. The entire internet would have to route through it. The crime-predicting computers would have to access things like school grades, queues on streaming services, book queues from libraries or Kindle, prison records. Any data gaps would cause the computers to misassess a situation. Then we would have to have police officers willing to act on the computer's predictions. As we all know, currently, the police can't arrest someone for a crime they haven't yet committed. For that to change, our entire legal system would have to change. No longer would the expression be innocent until proven guilty. It would be guilty by machine. So it would take a lot of time to prove to the police and to judges that the computer is right. You might have a 5-year period, for example, in which all arrests are compared to the computer's prediction. Although, of course, you'd have a bit of a paradox. If an alleged criminal was brought in that the computer hadn't anticipated, did the police catch the wrong person, or was the computer wrong? How could they reconcile that discrepancy? Obviously, there would be huge protests against the development and deployment of a pre-crime system. No one wants to open their door and find police waiting to arrest them for a future crime perhaps they hadn't even thought about committing yet. Civil rights advocates would fight tooth and nail in court. Very likely, some cities and states would outlaw the use of a crime-predicting computer entirely. And so as not to overwhelm the system, police departments would likely have to limit how many criminals they arrested. If every single criminal was caught and incarcerated, it would likely overwhelm the prison system. There would probably either have to be more jails built or a reduction in the length of sentences. For example, the computer says that a 16-year-old is about to steal a pack of gum in a 7-Eleven, but the police let it go. These are just some of the things we would see in the lead-up to the implementation of a pre-crime system. Now, I don't want to get into signposts and indicators because we're running out of time, but I do want to say that what sounds like science fiction is, in some sense, already here. IBM's Crime Reduction Utilizing Statistical History, aka CRUSH, evaluates crime records, intelligence briefings, offender profiles, and even weather reports to identify where a crime is most likely to occur. It doesn't predict the offenders, only criminal geographic hotspots. This is called crime mapping. According to an unsourced article, CRUSH was credited at one point with a 31% reduction in crime and a 15% drop in violent crime specifically in Memphis. And CRUSH isn't the only game in town. There are multiple programs that conduct crime mapping. So it's not far-fetched to think that one day we might have a variation of Asimov's multivac.
Oh my goodness. Wow, guys, that was a lot. It's so fascinating that we can take something that's interesting, it's kind of a what if, it's imaginative, it's kind of abstract, and then apply some of those analytic tools that you guys have and make it much more interesting to think about and talk about. I'm really looking forward to next episode. It's Team A, Team B, you said, Karen. We're going to be looking at some of the exciting topics like cryptocurrency, whether that's like a revolutionary move towards Web 3.0, or is it like a massive Ponzi scheme? And I have so many questions. I know, Karen, you're so skilled and equipped with this conversation. But we look forward to seeing you guys on Gossiping.